This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson with you on the Community Radio Network. Now, over the years, festival arts administrators have come under a lot of fire. Often the criticism revolves around the perceived wastage of government funds, the poor quality of shows, or the seemingly elitist appeal of the programming. Sometimes it's the ego of the artistic director that gets in the way, sometimes it's a performance that works beautifully in Europe but doesn't seem to translate to Australian audiences. When it's all said and done, there is no greater indicator of a festival success than bums on seats.
On the festival circuit, the top job is that of the artistic director who creates, curates, commissions and ultimately is made accountable for what the public gets to see. It's a fine line between catering to the masses on one hand and sourcing challenging, engaging, world-class international art and performers that inspire, connect and are cutting edge, leaving a positive, lasting impression on the other hand.
Now, few people get it right. And like most jobs in the arts, you're only as good as your last event. Our guest today is at the top of his game. He has won a multitude of awards, directed the Adelaide Festival, the Sydney Festival, and he's the current artistic director of the Melbourne International Arts Festival. Here with us today, word for word, is artistic director Brett Sheehy. Welcome.
Good to be here, Sue and Dean. And yeah, a very provocative start, but I'm glad I got out of it at the end bit.
American Pie, why is that an important song to you?
I didn't choose American Pie.
No, I know, but you used to play it a lot in Sydney, I heard.
Oh, my God.
We do a lot of research
that's
here.
That's the truth. Look, it's one of those kind of, you know, coming-of-age songs, I think. I think it's kind of, you know, obviously lyrically beautiful. I love the kind of, you know, multi-layers of meaning over the generations people have tried to put into the words. Don McLean, you know, if you ask him what it's about, I think his answer has always been, you know, it's a space for you to create what meaning you want to find in it. And you know, look, the truth is, you know, I come from a kind of background of theatre, but before that even a background of kind of language. I'm in at university, my majors, though I never got my degree, were in English literature and linguistics, and I've always loved text. And so, you know, poetry and then, you know, songs around poetry have always appealed to me. So yeah, kind of MacLean, Leonard Cohen, that kind of world, Dylan, that's kind of, yeah, where my heart finally is in terms of songwriting, meaningful lyrics to beautiful music.
Well, you can't understand, let's face it, you can't understand some of the things that people are singing nowadays, and it's not just because I'm over 40. It's not. I mean, there are songs, they're screaming at us, and I have no idea what they're saying or what I'm supposed to take from the music. So.
Yeah, so I'm frequently kind of Googling for kind of the lyrics yes. list online. And, you know, I'm one of those, you know, people who dreadfully sings along to the song and find out 10 years later I've been singing the wrong lyrics.
Oh, I'm still doing that now. Years. Now, I want to go back to, before you became artistic director, you had a bit of, you've very different background, really. You worked as a lawyer, a gardener, a cleaner. And they're all very, very different in themselves.
And you've done your research.
Oh, yeah. And from the artistic director role. So let's go back to the whole lawyer. Didn't suit you?
I just don't want to bore you terribly. Look, I never actually finished the law. What happened was my family were deeply involved in law in Queensland. I had no idea coming out of school what I wanted to do. I knew if I went into law, I shouldn't admit this, but I knew I'd have an easy ride of it. Professionally, I'd probably kind of, get reasonable jobs along the way. So I just went into law for something to do. Truth is, though, what was really attracting me was the art side of that, because it was arts law. And that's where kind of, English literature, linguistics, I think I did psychology and philosophy in year one. Those things I loved, but, I kept kind of trying to become a lawyer. So I actually dropped in and out of Queensland University three times over a six-year period. At the very end, I thought, okay, Brett, if you work for a law firm, maybe you'll learn to love it. I started my articles with a law firm on the Gold Coast, and it was a law firm which at the time represented Russ Hinds, Mike Gore, all of the kind of white shoe brigade on the Gold Coast and the kind of Queensland developers. And maybe it was in that period I decided even more so that law wasn't for me. My partner, who'd been working at Gold Coast Hospital, got transferred to a hospital in Sydney. I followed a year later. That's when I started gardening and office cleaning just to make ends meet. I then started writing reviews for $10 a review for a little street newspaper in Sydney called On the Street. I did that for maybe 8 months. That then got me into the theatres in Sydney. I got free tickets to every show in town. Then a job came up as an usher at Sydney Theatre Company at the New Wharf Theatre with the opening of that theatre in 1984. I became an usher. So I was seeing every Sydney Theatre Company production, did that for 6 months. Then finally a job came up at Sydney Theatre Company for assistant to the director, which was like a gopher, getting glasses of water, photocopying, etc. And then I was with Sydney Theatre Company for 10 years as assistant to the director, artistic associate, literary manager, then working on kind of texts and my love of that, then deputy general manager. Then I went to Sydney Festival in 1995.
Oh, my God. Well, you've just ruined my whole question line. You've just given everything. Let's go back to being a critic. I know Gene knows that I go on a journey with my stories.
Yeah.
Now, how hard was that? And it must be on the other foot now because people are looking at you going, oh, I don't like that.
Yeah, look, I think I was an awful critic. I think every review was more about me than the work. I think I was showing off horrendously. I was a young man. I hope your listeners aren't offended by this, but, scientific research has now shown that, empathy doesn't develop in the male brain until you're at least 25. So I don't think
I was going to say it might be a little later.
I don't think I had enough empathy for the artist. So I would say, my reviews were kind of tough and a bit show-offy. I do a lot of research for them, that said, so they were kind of well-researched. But, I can't say I'm tremendously proud of my reviewing career such as it was. However, having done that, it has made me kind of appreciate what's involved in reviewing work, and it's probably helped me bounce a bit more when I do read tough reviews from time to time of my own work. But that said, look, of course I still get upset. We're all human, but it's kind of, three sleeps and I'm over it.
I imagine you'd have to be your own greatest critic now.
Yeah.
In what you're doing.
Yeah.
Do you rely on a critical judgment of overseas artists when you're assessing them and that sort of thing?
Do you mean reviews they've received?
Yeah, yeah.
Look, I read them, but I've never let them deviate me from the main game. I mean, I remember when I kind of co-commissioned with some people in London a new production of a piece called The Black Rider, which Tom Waits created with Robert Wilson, the director, and it opened in London at the Barbican, and it got kind of one star across the board because they have the star system in Britain, and that was over kind of six newspapers. But all I knew was sitting in there, it absolutely gave me the kick in the chest that I physically get whenever I see great art. So I didn't care less, really. It may influence me if I was wavering, if universally it seemed that, critical opinion was against something. Maybe if I was wavering, but I can't recall it ever stopping me from doing something.
Now, you must travel a lot to source these artists from all around the world.
Yeah.
How much of your year is spent out finding these new materials?
Yeah, look, it maybe sounds glamorous. It's so not. Maybe it was at the start, but look, I was really lucky because from my first year with Sydney Theatre Company back in 85, I've had to travel for work at least once internationally every single year since then. So we're talking, is that what, 25 years ago?
To other festivals or just...
No,
to...
at that time, at Sydney Theatre Company, for those 10 years, it was quite specifically and exclusively to America and Britain. It was seeing new plays and then buying the rights and negotiating the rights for those plays to present them in Australia. So it was exclusively theatre then. Of course, if I was in town in New York or in London and there was an amazing dance production or music event on, I'd go along. So that's where it began. I mean, the value in that is kind of the back catalogue, I suppose, of kind of artist relationships that I've been able to develop over the years. At the moment, I probably travel, I do kind of two big and one small trips a year. I think all up kind of a six-week block, maybe a three-week block, and then 2 one-week blocks, something like that. So it's on the road a fair bit. And look, you know, of course, you know, it's the best job in the world and I love it. But you know, my caveat on my enthusiasm for it is simply that most of the work is not in the big, glamorous capitals. It's not happening in Paris, New York and London. It's happening, I mean, what I have in front of me now is our outdoor show in Alexandra Gardens, and I went to a town called Tourcoing in northern France. Tomorrow in a year, our big opera, I saw in a little town called Munster in Germany. So what it is it's actually arriving in this town at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, checking into the hotel, having a shower, getting changed, getting to the theatre, and then 9 o'clock the next morning, I'm checking out and I'm on a plane or a train onto the next city. It really is a kind of bus and truck whistle stop tour. So in terms of tourism and kind of lounging around and, you know, shopping down the Champs-Élysées, nothing could be further from the truth.
We're still jealous of you. It doesn't matter how bad you make it sound, all right? Okay, you're going to
it's
Paris.
Tragic, isn't it?
Yeah. So absolutely no sympathy, all right?
Okay. Thank you, Sue.
We'll just let you know that right now.
I feel really good about that.
That's okay. That's what I'm here for. Now, you're talking about travelling the world and finding these great artists. What about in Australia?
Yeah, and look, that's absolutely a critical part of the job as well. We are Melbourne's international arts festival, and certainly our core business and our core mission is that kind of sourcing or kind of co-creating major international work to bring to Australia. And in fact, this was kind of the springboard for all of the capital cities of Australia in creating their international arts festivals. The fact that, you know, we are still very isolated. We're so far from where much of the great art in the world is happening. And I actually see the job hugely as a responsibility to the artistic community in Australia as well, especially, you know, 20, 22, 25-year-old young people who are artists creating work. They just can't afford to be on the road for months at a time seeing work. So if I can, in their genre, bring what I believe is the best of the work over here, that can't help but inform their practice to see what their colleagues internationally are doing.
But I'm saying, what about the great work that's going on here? You're talking about sourcing work from overseas,
yes.
All these, you know, very lovely places. But we've got great artists here who can't fund it. They can't get bums on seats. And it's not because they're not good. It's just because they haven't got the money that's needed to publicise work now. And
yeah,
the Fringe Festival and everything that's going on now in Melbourne. We've got some great talent. How are you getting that talent into the Melbourne festivals?
If you want to consult your brochure, you'll see that we actually have, I think, in fact, the figure is here.
No,
we
I'm saying, have, what's the process of, because you're travelling overseas, I know that we've got Melbourne artists in there.
I get it, yeah. Look, obviously I'm here a lot as well. I'm here for months and months. Since arriving here, I then began conversations with a number of artists. From my conversations with Rachel Mazalong and Neil Bidgery, we now have the world premiere of Jack Charles versus the Crown. From my conversations with Moira Finucane, we have the fantastic Carnival of Mysteries, which has now, I think, something like 43 artists contributing to it.
That looks amazing.
It does,
amazing. My conversations, obviously, with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, and they're working with Thomas Sadesh from overseas. So, look, I get between 12 and 15 submissions a day. Those submissions sometimes are just the germ of an idea. Sometimes they're a full proposed production. 12 to 15 a day times 365 gives you an idea of the scale. So what I have to immediately do is divide them into the categories of, I mean, really immediately, on my screen, of no interest, of possible interest, of passionate interest. okay? So then I move with The Possible and Passionate. From those, shake down a number of events which join the short list, which I carry with me all the time, 24/7, which sits at between 450 and 500 productions. From that, then I draw down, you know, where are the events that will enhance or have as the best platform this program. And that's the key thing for me. I mean, I agree with you, say there are so many wonderful artists in this city creating great work, but I do think it's imperative that they choose and that we presenters choose the right platform for the work. I mean, we have a massive Fringe Festival. We have a fantastic Next Wave Festival for emerging artists. We have the whole Full Tilt program at the Arts Centre. We have multiple companies across every single genre funded full-time year-round to present Melbourne work. What gets on the international festival stage is the work that, in my view, has been created specifically for or has the potential to be presented on other international festival stages. So what it means is when my festival colleagues from Caracas, from Shanghai, from Johannesburg, and from Buenos Aires fly in for the festival, they're only here for a few days, and if they want to look at Australian work, I think the responsibility is on me that the work they see is work that I am saying, this actually represents Australian artistic practice in the 21st century, and you should put it on your stages. That then requires a degree of professionalism, a degree of kind of depth of experience, all of those things, and that's just the benchmark I set for myself, and that's what I apply to the work.
Well, the theory behind that is you're showing the best of what we've got as well.
Yeah.
And of the 908 artists presenting,
yes,
658 are Australian anyway.
Yes.
So, and 250 are international. So we've got the lion's share of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, the other thing is, you know, I mean, I come from the world of theatre, which can tend to be a slightly kind of myopic world. And I mean, you know, I would hope that theatre practitioners as well as dance practitioners would understand that, you know, a cellist with an orchestra or someone who's, you know, playing guitar in a band at the Forum, they are artists too. But there are some sectors of the arts who ignore all that and they just specifically focus down on their art form, and that's all that matters to them. And I'm really, really keen on this festival actually presenting work across every single art form and actually acknowledging that the barriers between art forms are dissolving constantly, that you know, all art forms now speak to each other, and no assessment of art in the 21st century can be made by excluding any art form from that.
You're a very, very passionate man. It's beautiful to see. Absolutely beautiful to see.
In fact, Brett, you're renowned for your boundless energy and you present that wherever you go. Your presentation style is the only person I can, and in the arts that I can put it even close to, is the likes of David McAllister, who speaks with such passion about the ballet. You do the same for your festivals. So we will take a little break. We'll speak to the Artistic Director of Melbourne International Arts Festival a little further. You're with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson across Australia on the Community Radio Network.
On the Community Radio Network from Melbourne's Joy 94.9, this is Word for Word.
You're with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson across Australia on the Community Radio Network. This is Word for Word, and we're speaking to the Artistic Director of the Melbourne International Festival, Brett Sheehy. Now, Brett, you worked under Leo Schofield, I believe.
I did.
That must have been an experience.
It was fantastic.
A good training ground.
Look, I've been, you know, blessed, for want of a better word, by being mentored by astonishing people. Richard Werrett, first of all, was my boss at Sydney Theatre Company. At the time, my chairman was Donald McDonald, who went on to chair the ABC and now the Classification Board. Then my general manager was Michael Lynch, who went on to run Southbank in London and the Australia Council and the Sydney Opera House. And then at Sydney Festival, I was mentored by Anthony Steele, first up, the great Adelaide Festival director, and then Leo, and I was Leo's deputy director for 4 years, and in fact, my office was like an annex to his, and, you know, we had the door open always, so I was actually party to every single conversation, negotiation and deliberation he had on Sydney Festival and planning the Olympic Arts Festival for 4 years. And it was you know, the experience and learning curve of a lifetime.
Now, I just want to take a little snapshot of both the Sydney Festival and the Melbourne Festival. Sydney seems a lot more free public in its programming.
Yes.
And yet Melbourne seems a lot more well, ticketed to begin with. Ticketed to begin with.
Yeah.
So tell me why the two are so different.
Yeah, look, the two things driving that mainly are climate and time of year. Sydney's is a high summer festival. Even though there is rain, you know, obviously, occasionally, the capacity to do outdoor work is just phenomenal. At any time, you can run multiple outdoor events and, you know, you'll be pretty well okay weather-wise. And the other one is simply budget. The Sydney City Council and Events New South Wales have poured, I think I can say here, literally millions of dollars, I mean millions, into Sydney Festival, exclusively and specifically for those huge, large, free outdoor celebrations. We don't have a tradition of that so much in Melbourne. As you guys know from last year and this year, I'm pushing in that direction. I'm presenting outdoor international theatre productions for families and the general public in each of my festivals. I was terrified that I might, you know, only do it on an opening night and it be rained out or weathered out. So on each occasion, I'll run it for a short season so that even if, you know, one day the weather's inclement, people still have a chance to go on another day. So this year, over the Friday night, Saturday night and Sunday night, we had the big outdoor opening, similar to last year. But look, I'm totally up for building as much as I possibly can the free and outdoor component. I think they sit naturally with the ticketed indoor component. I'm so conscious in all the work I do that my job is to run an international arts festival. It is not an international arts symposium or conference. And the word festival in the history of mankind, it is a sacred, magical, and wonderful word, and it absolutely requires a sense of celebration. That doesn't mean that the art needs to be thin or you know, cheap entertainment. You can celebrate deep, dark, great art, but it must be a celebration of art for the community in which it's presented. So, onwards, the more outdoor work I can do, the better.
And the family work too. I mean, it's really important to get the kids exposed to this sort of
stuff.
Yeah,
and look, you know, I mean, I don't have children myself, but when I was at Grupo Puka last night, Chaosmos, the big show down in Alexandra Gardens, and there were like, you know, mums, dads, and strollers and toddlers, and these little kind of 4 and 5 year olds just looking up at the sky at this production with their mouths open in just sheer wonder and joy. Nothing is better than that in terms of what you can deliver to someone as an artistic experience, especially someone so young, open, innocent, and unjaded.
And the long-term impact of that has got to be amazing.
Has to be. Yeah.
It has to be. Not only may they become presenters themselves, but the greater the exposure, I mean, the more wealthy that the, what's the word, spirit.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the more worldly and open, you know, our children are, the more, you know, worldly and open our world can be.
Now, talking about worldly and open, you're an outwardly gay man.
Yes.
Yes, so you're open, out and out and proud and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
In school, in the media at the moment, there's a lot about kids being bullied, harassed, being gay, and a suicide issue that we're trying to target at the moment.
Yes.
Were you affected by that? Has that affected your career or your schooling?
My being gay?
Yes.
Look, at school, to be honest, no. I had a dream run at school, actually. I went to a Christian Brothers school, exclusively male, in Brisbane. I had fantastic friends. I don't think, you know, my sexuality really emerged until kind of, you know, fairly late adolescence, till kind of, you know, 15, 16, 17. By that age, I was kind of almost getting ready to move into university. I certainly wasn't outwardly gay at school, but I also didn't feel I was suppressing anything. I had girlfriends when I was at school, but frankly, that was because it was kind of just easier to have girlfriends, and I kind of loved girls as well, even though, you know, I was preferring men. I mean, you know, like most of us, I think, from the time I was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, I knew that I was gay. I knew what I was attracted to. I remember, you know, having, you know, dreams about, you know, being grabbed by cowboys and slung on the back of their horse and, you know, riding along. I mean, there was nothing sexual in it. But, yeah, I mean, the signs were there clearly. So, yeah, look at school, I was really, really lucky. At university is probably where it became trickier when, you know, I was starting to go to kind of gay bars rather than, I'd go with my straight mates to, you know, their pubs, but I'd also be going to gay bars as well. And then some of them started to say, you know, Brett, what's going on here? But I've never in my life been discriminated against or rejected because of my sexuality. But I think that's for a number of reasons. One, I've always been attracted to the kind of career path that I went into. I mean, we all know it's a fact that, you know, careers in the arts are probably the easiest ride you have as a gay person. Had I stayed in law in Queensland, it may have been a completely different ball game. Actually,
might have been very interesting.
Yeah.
I think you would have been a barrister.
Now, going a little bit more deeply into your life, suicide has touched your life?
Yeah, look, it has. I alluded earlier to my moving to Sydney to join my partner, who was a doctor who'd been at Gold Coast Hospital and went down to St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. And he in the very kind of early days in the 80s, was exclusively dealing with young guys who were HIV positive. As we know, at the time, it was hopeless. There was nothing. I mean, you know, the combination therapies came in kind of quite late in the piece. Paul, my partner, was trying a lot of quite radical things, kind of vitamin B infusions and oxygen infusions. And I mean, the fact is, because we didn't have a clue. And the problem was, that as time went on, the effect it had on him as a carer was astronomical, and he just started to lose patient after patient after patient. And the kind of relentless loss for him of these boys who were, you know, 20, 21, 22 years old, they were babies, it was staggering. And that was his entire world, except for, you know, his friends outside that world. And it just got too much for him. And he committed suicide and left a kind of a lengthy suicide note, which talked about that and the impact of that. And really, it was the hopelessness. He wasn't HIV positive himself, which you know, made it tragic as well. But you know, that just the hopelessness and the complete lack at the time of light at the end of the tunnel staggered him. And I remember, you know, he was so shaken by the fact that Reagan, even, you know, in 1987, had still refused to actually utter the word AIDS. And I think that by that time we were getting around the 100,000 deaths mark in America of you know, fine young men. And, yeah, it was terrible. But you know, look what came of that was Paul and I had a conversation a week before it happened, and it's really happy to be wise after the event. But I remember in that conversation he was reaching out, actually. And though you know, one says you should never ever feel guilt if you lose someone, I think you should actually take something on for yourself in terms of being watchful and listening. And you know, I mean, I have taken that on, and I am more watchful, and I do listen more when I see friends who you know, maybe are in moments of crisis. So, I mean, it happened. It kind of completely rocked my world. In hindsight, you know, I don't think it's impossible that I could have prevented it had I been listening. I was on the go, 30-year-old, you know, just whipping around. And I was, yeah, sure, Paul, you'll be fine, mate. Then onwards.
But it changed your life. I mean, it must have made you think, okay, I'm here today. This is what I can do with my life.
Yeah, look it gave me it gave me a fearlessness. It really did. It gave me an urgency. It gave me we're on the planet once. All of those things. And you know, in that way, it's kind of influence on me. Yeah, it changed me considerably. That was the moment where, if you know, courage ever entered my personality, that was the moment it entered. And nothing that can ever happen to me, you know, can kind of change that. But I also kind of hate people, you know, said to me for a long time afterwards, "You poor thing, Brett." And I was like, I'm so not the poor thing here, you know. Poor Paul, frankly. And, you know, that's where all the sympathy should go, because I'm still alive and I've never in my life clearly faced a moment so dark and so terrible that I've gone where he went. And that's all we need to know. If the pain is so great that someone goes there, you know, that's what we should focus on. I mean, I hear people unconscionably saying things like, you know, what a selfish choice. And that's language is so repugnant to me. There is no choice. It is so dark, and there is no light at the end of the tunnel. They've only got one place to go, and that's the place they do go.
And is the passion that you've got now, just looking at you talk about the Melbourne Festival and all the festivals that you participated in, is that a driving force in that, in actually sharing life, celebrating the good things that we have in the world?
Yeah, look, I think it is. I mean, I'd actually thought of myself, up until Paul's death, I'd thought of myself and had described myself as a kind of slightly melancholic, kind of introverted, I thought I was this kind of fabulous, brooding, you know, quasi-intellectual.
Clearly you've transformed that.
Yes, I'm going to say.
well, at that moment, I kind of realised I'm not actually, because, you know, that's kind of what real depression is. Yeah. And it gave me a kind of levity, but yeah, look, totally it gave me a passion for life. And it gave me a kind of, you know, desperation to share. I mean, I get very little joy out of anything unless I'm sharing it with someone else.
Brett Shee, we're going to take another quick break. We're speaking to the artistic director of the 2010 Melbourne International Arts Festival, Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson, with you on Word for Word.
From Melbourne's Joy 94.9, nationally on the Community Radio Network, this is Word for Word.
We're speaking with Brett Shee. He's 25 years in the arts industry. Brett, I believe that Melburnians have embraced this year's festival like no other, and tickets are going gangbusters.
Yeah, look, I was thrilled. We opened on Friday night, I think, with 85% of our budget met before the curtain went up on the first show, which is just sensational.
It does mean, opening night, that's mental.
There are so many kind of, you know, sold-out performances. Happily, there are, you know, great tickets to a lot of work as well. But yeah, look, I'm thrilled to bits with that. And it kind of meant we opened about 10% ahead of this time last year. Why that's the case, I honestly have no idea. I mean, you know, the program is the program, and I put it out there each year and just fingers crossed hope it connects. But maybe, you know, now having been here for you know, a year and a half, I'm developing some kind of relationship with the Melbourne audience, and maybe, you know, if they came last year, they thought, oh, let's give it a go again next year. Not sure, but yeah, I'm thrilled to bits.
Let's talk a little bit about the program. You clearly have some favourites. Robert Lepage's in your program.
Yeah.
You've worked with him before.
Yeah, one of the great kind of, you know, theatre directors of our time, with a production called The Blue Dragon. Sometimes Robert makes these works that are, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours long. This one, I think, is 75 minutes straight through. And it's all of, you know, his kind of theatrical magic condensed into that very kind of magical time. Look, he's a master. His work is visually stunning. A fantastic narrative. You see things happen on stage theatrically that you've never seen before. And it's a great story. It's a businesswoman from Montreal, wants to adopt a little Chinese baby, goes to Shanghai for the adoption, runs into an ex-friend of hers who's an expat Canadian who has an art gallery in Shanghai, and then into the mix comes a young Chinese artist. And it's exploration of the relationships between the three of them, but also, you know, contemporary China and the role of art in contemporary China. This weird China that, you know, is a totalitarian state, but also a deeply capitalist state as well now. It's quite complex, but beautiful. But look, finally, it's a wonderful, heartwarming love story. And yeah, a great work from Robert.
The Melbourne crowds, do they push you to say, come on, show us something a bit darker, a bit deeper? Are audiences getting to that stage?
More black?
Well, no.
There's so much
black. I like more black. Do you know what I mean? Because they don't just want to be a bum on a seat anymore. They want to go to that next level in performance now. We're sort of past that stage, aren't we?
Yeah, Sue, look, like, I think that's absolutely the case. I think it's festival audiences, actually. I think that people expect of their festivals all over the country that they should not be seeing work which they could see at any other time during the year. That's the normal kind of run of work. And I think that's the job for us. I mean, I often say interesting is not good enough. There is too much great art in the world, and you know, we have the opportunity in festivals to present it, to actually just, in a kind of shopping trolley way, go along the supermarket aisles of art and say, oh, that's interesting, that's interesting, that's interesting, there's a festival. I think for every single work, I should be able to look you guys and every audience member in the eye and be able to say with absolute truth and passion, I had a burning reason why you must see this work, and I will tell you why. Whether it connects or not is another thing, but I think that's the responsibility on me to present that.
But you talk about a kick in the guts kind of moment when you see these productions, and is that what you're talking about? It has to have that huge impact at whatever emotional, psychological physical, spiritual level.
Yeah, and look, because I've been fortunate to see a lot of work over the years, a hell of a lot of work, now I do get a kind of instinctive visceral reaction, and it does. It actually affects me physically when I'm sitting there, that kind of moment, and I can feel it physically in the upper part of my chest, and it actually kind of gets me there, and I know this is great art.
You like to debut international artists.
Yes.
It's got to be, there's more of them out there than there are good local artists.
Yes.
So how do you find the cream of the crop when you only travel, I guess, you know, really a few weeks of the year?
Yeah.
How do they come to you?
Yeah, look, it is quite focused. I will already have probably been in touch with the company or the artist. I have now, obviously, a network of friends and artists around the world who keep me informed of what's coming up, what they're developing, what people they know are developing, and so on.
And how far ahead do you work?
Oh, gosh, around about 2 years. Okay. I mean, I've just been confirmed for 2012, and truth is I've been working on 2012 for maybe 6 months before that anyway, in the hope of. And that's just because, you know, so many of these artists, major international artists, their own schedules are booked kind of 2 years out. But that issue of debut is incredibly important, especially for Melbourne. I mean, one thing I really want Melbourne to become is a destination festival. I hate the idea of a kind of homogenizing of our international arts festivals where we just tour one production from city to city to city. So I love to kind of identify artists who've never been to Australia before, whose work is astonishing, and presented exclusively in Melbourne. So anyone in this country or the region who wants to see it has to come here to see it. I mean, two examples that we have coming up. There's a guy called Ivo van Hove, who works in the Netherlands, and I think he's one of the great five theatre makers of our age. I mean that. He's the first person ever who I've seen completely successfully fuse the two art forms of cinema and theatre in an absolutely astonishing, successful way. And his piece, which is called Opening Night, though it's not on opening night, it's a theatricalization of the great Cassavetes film, Opening Night, which starred Jenna Rollins. And we actually have six massive kind of, you know, cinema cameras feeding images in all the time with professional European cinematographers. It means that what Ivo has done is, whereas cinema took from the stage in the 20th century all of its best conventions to make cinema the art form of the 20th century, Ivo is now taking back from cinema for the stage its conventions. So things like the close-up, things like audio veracity, where two performers can be right in close and tight and be speaking at a truthful volume to each other. Things like backstage action, where he can actually kind of bring that in through cinema. And it's just the most incredible thing. I think he has created something which is a brand new art form for our times. I mean that. It's incredible, and I think it will define the direction theatre goes in the next 10 years. The Knife, I mean, who've just written an opera, their first opera, the Scandinavian electropop duo called Tomorrow in a Year. Again, an extraordinary artistic creation, which has this wonderful operatic through line, but also this great kind of electronica and kind of pop aesthetic to it as well. Visually stunning. Those are the kind of things that, you know, are kind of not once in a lifetime experiences, but, you know, certainly once in a decade experiences. And to be able to present them to Melbourne exclusively just for us, I love.
There might be that once in a lifetime for a lot of people, though.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
You're a world premiering En Masse. Can you tell us about En Masse?
Yeah, Genevieve Lacey and Mark Silver. I'm the great Genevieve Lacey, who's a Melbourne composer and musician, a really, really fine artist. And she worked with Mark, and he created this kind of surround, this visual surround video environment in which she could then perform a composed through musical arrangement for it. It's a beautiful, meditative, gorgeous space in which to enter. And what I love about that work is, as quite a lot of the work in this year's festival, there is this kind of feeling of spirituality to it, and actually entering spaces and being able to meditate and contemplate. And that infuses a lot of the work this year.
Now, no festival gets off the ground without some serious, decent sponsorship.
Yes.
You've got government partners, but for the first year, you've got Foxtel on board.
Yeah. The first time the festival has had a principal partner in 8 years, and a fantastic partner. I mean,
that's a pretty big achievement.
Yeah. Look, I'm thrilled with that. It's a very substantial sponsorship arrangement. It will be for 3 years. So it will be for, you know, my next 3 years, 2010, 11 and 12. And endless synergies in terms of broadcast rights for work that we present, in terms terms of, you know, the multiple Foxtel channels where we can actually produce content, as they call it, for the channels and vice versa. And look, my partner Steve and I, we've been Foxtel subscribers for 11 years. And I can't tell you, I have hundreds of hours on IQ backed up, which are documentaries about the Forsyth Company, dance documentaries, visual art documentaries, music documentaries. And they feed, just in terms of kind of an encyclopedia base, they feed a lot of, you know, kind of the information I have about work.
So what they'll now be doing that is, I guess, for our artists internationally.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And indeed, you know, our closing event, which is the great Seven Songs to Leave Behind concert, Foxtel will be broadcasting. It's an amazing collaboration between what I think is Melbourne's, you know, greatest recent gift to the Australian music industry, the Black Armband, working with John Cale, Sinead O'Connor, Ricky Lee Jones, and a lineup of fantastic international artists.
I couldn't believe it when I read the lineup on that one, and just stunning.
Yeah,
it's a must see.
I'm thrilled with that. And you know, a guy called Stephen Richardson, who's, you know, one of our collaborators who's producing it and has worked with the Black Armband since its beginnings, has kind of put the concert together on that theme of kind of spirituality and mortality. And we just decided we really want to use Maya Music Bowl. We want a big outdoor concert. And we wanted to now move Black Armband into its international collaboration field. And, Seven Songs to Leave Behind is it, where each of the artists perform the seven songs they want to leave humanity when they leave us behind.
I just love the way you're blending the world and making the world a smaller place. I mean, there's international here, we're going international, the fact that we're getting art out and about and we can access these amazing events. So thank you.
My pleasure. That's the job, though. That's what you pay me to do.
Paying you. I'm not feeling sorry for you.
Your tax dollars pay me. I hope you're paying tax.
No, I don't. I avoid it.
Okay.
We've been speaking with Brett. She is from the Artistic Director of the Melbourne International Arts Festival. You can check out more information on ticketing and the program at melbournefestival.com.au. Brett, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I love the passion. Thank you so much.
Infectious.
It is infectious.
Sue Wilkinson, thank you.
Dean Beck, thank you.
We'll catch you again next week. There will be a podcast of this interview on the Joy website, joy.org.au. Till next week, take care and bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Brierley and presented by Dean Beck, Sue Wilkinson and Tim Newton.
Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.